Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Earthquakes rattle California on a regular basis, but in many cases, you don't even feel the jolts. Over the past 4 days, we've been hit by 10 earthquakes with a 2 to 3.3 magnitude. This is in Northern California. On Sunday, the U.S. Geological Survey reported a 3.3 magnitude earthquake in San Francisco. This happens nearly a year after the 6.0 earthquake struck Napa Valley, which killed one person and caused $400 million in property damage. Northern California is one of the most earthquake-prone regions in the country. Earlier this year, the U.S. Geological Survey updated the statewide earthquake probability report, showing a 72% chance that a 6.7 or larger quake will hit the Bay Area before the year 2044. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about whether we're ready for the big one, how resilient is our infrastructure, and what has changed since the 1989 devastating Loma Prieta earthquake, which killed 63 people, caused $6 billion in damage, and 16,000 structures were destroyed. Today, we're joined by Danielle Mueller, the Resilience Program Coordinator at the Association of Bay Area Governments. They look at response, recovery, and preparedness. And Danielle joins me in studio. Hi, Danielle. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Anna Marie Jones, Executive Director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters, or CARD. They provide emergency preparedness and disaster response resources for nonprofits, faith groups, and community agencies serving the state's most vulnerable residents. And Anna Marie also joins me in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in. Nice to see you again.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
I still have the whistle you gave me on my keychain from last show. So thank you.
Awesome.
We're also joined by Dr. Jack Boatwright, senior seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And Jack also joins us in studio. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Thank
nice
you for
to
coming
be here.
In. So, Jack, I had to read this number and make sure we got it right a couple of times. The U.S. Geological Survey recently updated the statewide earthquake probability report, showing a 72% chance that a 6.7 or larger quake will hit the Bay Area before the year 2044. And we already got an email from Greg asking, how did you come up with that high percentage?
Oh, well, we actually came up with the first probability report was published just after the Loma Prieta earthquake. And that came up with, I think, a 68% chance. What we do to determine the probability reports is we excavate faults. Because in the Bay Area, in California, our historical record is so short. I mean, there really been written records only since 1770, right? We don't have a long enough record of earthquakes to use the historical record to predict earthquakes. So what we do is we excavate faults, such as the Hayward Fault or the San Andreas, and we try to determine prior earthquake chronology on those faults. The most successful trench that we have was on the Hayward Fault. We found a colleague of mine, Jim Leenkamper, found 10 events going back 3,000 years. No, and it's a really tremendous piece of work. But it's hard to find those sites on all the faults we need to find.
So Greg also has a question about faults. He says, talk about the new appreciation for the interconnected web of faults. Does it not allow for the diffusing of large fault stresses rather than the building up of stress in isolated faults, thus enabling many small quakes rather than one big one? Is that not a possibility?
There's a large problem with small quakes relieving stress. If you had magnitude fours, say, relieving the stress that would build up to a magnitude 6, they'd be happening on the order of once every couple of days. People would get so sick of the events. We don't actually have that. The small earthquakes happen sort of sporadically, but they never happen enough of them to actually relieve stresses.
So when you read this data,
how should the public make sense of this? Because, again, a 72% chance, that's really high, of a 6.7 or larger quake will hit the Bay Area before 2044.
Well, I think that the public should just assume that large damaging earthquakes will occur in their lifetime in the Bay Area, and not worry about whether it's 72% or 60% or 90%. The sort of more positive spin on things comes from the way earthquakes actually occur, which is the Gutenberg-Richter law, which means that it's more likely to have a magnitude 7 earthquake than a magnitude 8 earthquake.
Okay, so we should just assume that this, a big one, is going to happen, well, again, if we were around in 1989 in California in our lifetimes. Danielle, talk a little bit about what that means to you. How do you convey this information to the public? Because I've talked to a lot of people about earthquakes, and so many people are not prepared at all.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to kind of wrap your head around, especially when you've got a lot of other things in your day-to-day life that really kind of take precedent to this larger event that's kind of out there in the future. So we talk to residents a lot about making sure that you have the water in your house that you need, and that you have food supply that can be in your pantry. And just making sure that you have kind of the things that you need to get through a couple of days in your home, camping supplies and those kinds of things that may already be in your house, but making sure that they're in a safe location that you can access after an earthquake. And then the other thing that we talk to people a lot about is making sure that your the structure of your home is safe. So there's a lot of things that people can do if you live in single-family homes, especially older, kind of pre-World War II single-family homes, to make sure that they're bolted to their foundations. And if you live in apartment buildings, many cities have programs called soft story building retrofit programs that are requiring more and more apartments to be evaluated for a particular weakness that happens on the ground floor parking area or commercial area of apartment buildings, to make sure that those buildings are evaluated and upgraded. And that's a requirement here in San Francisco.
And if you're a renter, how should you deal with that?
If you're a renter, that you should ask questions of your landlord when you move into your apartment. And if you're living there already, you should ask questions and make sure that you encourage your landlord to follow the requirements in San Francisco to upgrade their buildings.
And Anna Marie, what would you add to that? It seems like, for example, when the earthquake hit Napa Valley last year, a lot of people were saying, oh, I should get a kit or some water or some food, and then it sort of dies down until something happens again. What can you tell us about how the public responds to what we see in the media?
This is an absolute obsession for me, as you know.
Right.
I spent the first, I don't know, 10 years of my life in advertising and marketing research, and I'm sort of the extremist about this. We have spent billions of dollars, and I mean many billions of dollars, telling people about the earthquakes, the floods, the fires, terrorism, and then telling them they should have a kit and all of these things. All the research shows that that doesn't work. And how do we know it doesn't work? Because most people aren't prepared, and it's not for want of billions of dollars being spent doing that. And the reality is that if we want the public to embrace this conversation, we would never be using fear, threat-based language, that incredibly damaging graphic imagery. People don't need to see floating bodies in their crushed houses and the messages of doom and gloom. And I'm not saying that horrible things won't happen. I'm not an earthquake denier. I mean, I've chosen this as my profession. But the reality is, if you want people to take action, if you want nonprofits and the human infrastructure to be strong and resilient and be full partners in this, it would just be a very different message. And we talk about things like brain training, how if we could get people to start training their brains on the ways that it'll really help in a crisis. You know, all of those things, like knowing how to MacGyver absolutely anything, knowing how to do structured problem solving, make your brain an incredible resource for you. Using technology, oh my God, how much has changed in just a few years with technology. People should have the most programmed phones in the world so that their phones can be their external brain, and put those apps on there and all of these different things. And the truth is, if you do a few of these things, not only will you be much, much, much more prepared for disasters, you will be much more prepared for life. Anything that happens in life, you will be able to step up more powerfully, have more confidence, protect your family. I mean, I could go on really for the entire show, but it really is several billions of dollars to scare and threaten people and kill countless trees for things we know they're not going to do.
Who's making those decisions? Because we talked about this last time you were on the show a couple of years ago about these public outreach campaigns. Has anything changed now that you have the data that shows that these kinds of messages do not work?
No, there's so little change, and it's really painful to see because we know. In fact, years ago, they brought a bunch of experts to Washington, D.C., and we sat in a big room, and expert after expert came forth to tell exactly why this doesn't work. And still, there were people who wanted to hold on to the message. Why? Because they've got people trained in that message. They've got lots of brochures in that message. There are pamphlets and trainings and certifications all around that message. And now we have something that I consider to be more insidious, which is if you look at social media, you know, and really, I'm a big believer in Facebook. Facebook has made us more resilient and more connected. But the truth is, if you go on any of these sites, they make money because of people clicking and taking certain, you know, actions and how their behaviors play out. That's why you get those scary type headlines, right? It is clickbait. It's going to make people click on that link, and it's going to make people take that action. That's money in the bank for some company. The fact that that very same behavior literally stops people from taking action. The fact that the poorest communities wind up with increased anxiety and less ability to actually take action is really the hardest thing. At CARD, we face this all the time. And we don't have companies stepping up with that level of safety leadership saying, you know what, I am going to make sure, all of this politics and business aside, that the daycare centers where my employees are will indeed have plans. Where my parents are, that senior center will be able to respond. And that's the big difference, is that there's a lot of money in scaring the public, and we really need to get that level of passionate person or company that's willing to say, that aside, my people are going to be safe.
Jack, as a senior seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey, what goes through your mind when you hear Anna Marie, who has dedicated her life to reach out to the communities about this? And she says that this message just doesn't work. Fear-based messaging does not work.
Well, what goes through my mind is I don't even have a sufficient witch doctor mask in my office to scare people. I think the way I would look at what Anne-Marie was saying is that we're really, the idea of volunteerism on the part of the public, we've exhausted that. We're not going to get any more people to sign up by publishing more probability reports. I'm very gratified. I think what San Francisco did with mandating the soft first story ordinance is a really, really important step. And I think that and I hope that Danielle will agree with me, that we're seeing that the municipalities are carrying the spears on this. I agree. I don't think we're at the end of you know, eliciting responses from people by saying, oh, there's a big earthquake coming.
Yeah.
Dr. Jack Boatwright is senior seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Anna Marie Jones is executive director of collaborating agencies responding to disasters. They provide emergency preparedness and disaster response resources to nonprofits and community agencies. Danielle Mueller is the resilience program coordinator at the Association of Bay Area Governments, and they look at response, recovery, and preparedness. Today, we are talking about earthquakes and earthquake preparedness. Are you ready for the next big one? The U.S. Geological Survey just updated the statewide earthquake probability report, showing a 72% chance that a 6.7 or larger quake will hit the Bay Area before the year 2044. Another way to look at this is that another big earthquake will most likely happen in your lifetime in California. So what questions do you have about this? Are you prepared? If you have any questions about preparedness, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about Anne-Marie's thoughts and statements about the fact that fear-based messaging and threat-based images just don't work? What actually works for you? What makes you stop and say, I really need to take this seriously and think about not just a kit, but a preparation plan for my family and my neighbors and my community? And then also we're going to talk more about retrofits. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Danielle, Jack mentioned the Soft Story Retrofit Program in San Francisco. Mayor Ed Lee signed this into law 2 years ago, so it requires older wood-framed multifamily buildings in San Francisco to be retrofitted. And according to some reports, this costs around $100,000 for some structures, and sometimes owners push the expenses off to tenants. Can you talk about how that works?
So I just wanted to add on to Jack's earlier thought that I think that there's a huge role for public policy in earthquake preparedness. This is not the responsibility of each individual resident. While there is a responsibility to care for your family, but our regional earthquake preparedness is really the responsibility, I think, of our governments to also partner with us as individuals and to make sure that our structures are safe, that our roads are safe, that our buildings are safe. And I think the Soft Story program really made sure that renters who don't have a lot of control over the places that they live can also be sure that they live in safe buildings. So I think there's a really important role, and a lot of cities in the Bay Area are stepping up in a big way to kind of push the envelope in that, and which we're really excited about. So Soft Story retrofits were required in San Francisco starting about 2 years ago, and that program has really was in the works for many, many years through a citizen advisory committee developing and kind of figure out kind of how this would work and how it would play out and studying the problem. And so it's now rolled out and it's becoming quite successful. The costs of retrofit can be expensive. There are a number of financing mechanisms that are in place. Particularly, one of the more exciting ones is called PACE, which is the Property Assessed Clean Energy, was what it was originally used for, installing solar panels and clean energy systems on buildings. And now it can be used for seismic retrofit upgrades, which is really exciting. And the way PACE works is you can basically take out a loan against your property for 30 years, and you have no money up front, and you can pay it back over the 30-year time frame. And if you sell the building during that time, the loan actually stays with the property, so the owner doesn't carry that loan with them. So that does help with a lot of the financing. And there's other – San Francisco's working on a number of other financing mechanisms to try and help reduce the costs of these retrofits.
What other public policy changes would you like to see?
We would like to see more requirements or evaluation of single-family homes. So really trying to – the California Earthquake Authority is starting to roll out a program to provide incentives to homeowners for single-family homes to retrofit their buildings. There are still masonry buildings, brick buildings in the Bay Area that have not been retrofitted after many years of laws and programs to encourage that retrofit. And then there's also larger brick or concrete buildings that we know, are unsafe in earthquakes. So we're working our way through the problem, but we're kind of doing it one building type at a time, and we do have a ways to go.
And Anna Marie, what would you add? What kind of public policy changes would you like to see?
Oh, since I care most about the human infrastructure piece, I would love to see policies about embracing the science around messaging. The idea that we spend a penny of public dollars on messages that actually harm people. This isn't money that's just wasted because, oh, hey, it didn't work. This is using public dollars to put out messaging that increases people's level of anxiety, depression, you name it. I think we need to totally revamp that and change that, because it's a multi-billion dollar experience to do that, and it would change everything if we stopped doing that.
Who sets the tone? I mean, ultimately, who can make these decisions to change the messaging?
I think what we're really going to need are a few public businesses, you know, private sector businesses stepping up and saying, you know what, we're not doing this. And then other things start to align behind that, because right now you have all the top agencies that are in the emergency management world really believing a few things, that standardized messaging is the thing. So for years, you really couldn't try to push a different message because of the pressure from everyone to say, oh, no, 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 we must have the same message. I can't even begin to tell you how ridiculous it is to say in a place as diverse as we are that everyone should hear the same message. And literally there are arguments about whether we should tell people 3 days or 7 days or 10 days worth of food or water. Really? Are we honestly still having that conversation? Some people can't afford right now to have an extra day worth of food. Other people could have weeks worth of food. But yet we spend that kind of time and money. Hmm. And when I used to work for the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, every year you watch X number of pamphlets just get thrown out because, of course, no one used them. And, I mean, this is true when I worked with Red Cross. This is true with all of the major organizations. So I do believe some company, and I'm genuinely hoping someone here is listening and believes that they can make that difference, we could change it. I think, and my office is in Oakland. Oakland already has issues. I would love for Oakland to be the very first city in the country that embraces this entire fear-free messaging and have it spread and take over the country. Because really, it matters that we spend billions to get a negative result.
And before we go to break, I know you work with vulnerable populations. What messaging actually works with those populations? What's most effective?
We have a framework, and we call it Prepare to Prosper. So instead of focusing on the earthquake, flood, or terrorism, or any of those things, we ask communities, well, what is something that matters to you? And it doesn't matter what they say. Whatever it is that they are concerned with, they want to work toward, we open up our bag of preparedness tricks and pull out something that will serve them. I mentioned earlier, for example, the phone programming. If communities just took that on, they could help themselves with virtually every other project they ever wanted to do, whether it's graffiti abatement or anything like that, any crime reduction, pick whatever you want. If the community is united, if they have adopted certain basic protocols, if they have built their extra resilience, say, by organizing also online, they will be more effective at what it is they said they wanted to do. And by the way, they'll also be effective in earthquakes and preparedness and all of that. So it's really about shifting away from, oh, there's one conversation, to realizing there's an incredible number of preparedness skill sets that we could whip out and give them to serve their needs.
Anna Marie Jones is Executive Director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. Danielle Mueller is the Resilience Program Coordinator at the Association of Bay Area Governments. And Dr. Jack Boatwright is Senior Seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Today we are talking about earthquakes and earthquake preparedness. How ready are you? And what questions do you have? We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join in today's conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send your question via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say. Then at noon today, it's John Perry and Ken Taylor and Philosophy Talk. This week, God and the Fine-Tuned Universe. Their guest, Robin Collins, the author of God and the Laws of Nature.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about Ferguson a year later. How have your views on race and police changed? Since protests erupted a year ago, 24 states have adopted measures to reform police practices. Racial justice and police brutality issues are now making it into the platforms of presidential hopefuls. So what changes have been made? What else is needed? Join us tomorrow for that. And on Thursday, we will have a conversation about community choice and community power. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about earthquakes and earthquake preparedness. If you live in California, chances are you will live to see another big earthquake. So what questions do you have? Are you prepared? What messaging works for you? When do you stop and say, I really should think about this and take it seriously? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Does your community talk about these issues? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Danielle Mueller, Resilience Program Coordinator with the Association of Bay Area Governments. They look at response, recovery, and preparedness. Anna Marie Jones is Executive Director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. They work on emergency preparedness and disaster response with nonprofits and community agencies serving the state's most vulnerable residents. And Dr. Jack Boatwright is Senior Seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose and guests. I have a map of the major faults in the Bay Area. There seems to be about a half a dozen of them. My question is whether or not the percentage figure for another major earthquake in the Bay Area by 2044 applies to all those faults cumulatively, or whether or not there's a breakdown on how soon we might expect a fault, or excuse me, how soon we might expect an earthquake on any of the individual earthquake faults.
That's a very good question. The number is cumulative. If you look at the percentage, and I'm not really supposed to say this out loud, if you look at the percentage of or the probability of an earthquake in the next 30 years on any particular fault in the Bay Area, that's the highest number we have there is on the order of 27 or 28%. So you would grade that as any particular fault having an earthquake as being unlikely, but having an earthquake from the set of faults, from one of the set of faults, is likely.
Thank you for the question. Greg also wants to know if the public can download and read the peer-reviewed journal paper on the latest report.
The USERF paper is published now in BSSA.
Is it behind a paywall?
No.
Okay.
It is behind a paywall.
It is.
Yes. We should, if they went to BSSA, there is a version of that paper that is on the USGS open file website, and that's not behind a paywall.
Okay, great. And we will put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for the call, John, and thanks for the email, Greg. And let's go next to Cynthia in San Francisco. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
To let folks know about Nextdoor.com. It's a social neighborhood app. I'm not an employee, but I am a member. And it's partnering with the police to provide information and services, you know, of criminal activity, security, safety. And I think Nextdoor.com would be a great way of connecting people at the neighborhood level. It's an administered social media app, and, you know, a great way to have block parties about certain things and getting the word out about earthquake safety.
Thank you. What are your thoughts on the app, Anna Marie?
I'm a big fan of Nextdoor, and the thing that I think is really important is if we could get enough people to really monitor and insert the positive and really help people move away from the negative, because I have been involved in a few different conversations where people really do believe that scaring people about threats, whether it's robberies, whatever, is the way to do it. They feel that they are giving people a wake-up call. And the truth is, it pushes more people away from the conversation than it brings people in. But especially after you've been mugged, you have that adrenaline rush. And so people go on Nextdoor and they basically, you know, spew that level of anxiety into the site. And they really do not realize the degree to which it pushes so many people away. No one wants to feel that they're living in a community where any minute now someone is going to harm you. It's very hard to live that way. So if we could add the taking out the fear, yeah.
Jack?
I'll take advantage of my senior status here. One thing that that has really developed well in the Bay Area since the Loma Prieta earthquake is the neighborhood emergency response teams. And I would love to see them connected with the Nextdoor stuff. There's a very strong program in both San Francisco, throughout the Bay Area, in the NERT and CERT training. We didn't have any of that at the time of the Loma Prieta earthquake.
We actually have an email from Art about this. He says, NERT is a citywide neighborhood-based organization that trains preparedness volunteers, organizes neighborhoods, and helps San Franciscans get ready for earthquakes and other emergencies. And we'll put a link at on our website. What else can you tell us about NERT? Anna Marie?
Well, in Oakland, it's called CORE, and I'm a NERT graduate. And the great thing is that it is a wonderful way for people with that pre-existing desire to build community, right? It's about neighbors helping neighbors and neighbors planning together as neighbors. It should not, however, be looked at as the be-all and end-all of preparedness, because it really is about neighbors who live next to each other. What we have seen happen across the country is people try to make the NERT program the program for everything. So it should be, you know, oh, let's put NERT in the schools and let's make all the nonprofits take NERT. No, that's not actually the best thing, because businesses need much more of the continuity of operations type conversation than they need the neighbor. And knowing your neighbors is always good, but also NERT folks have always needed other things that they can do between exercises and such. So we've gotten lots of requests from NERT groups across the country for our types of tools so that they can actually keep the NERT conversation fresh and alive and not just focused on earthquake drill, you know.
Well, and Art also wanted to recommend the New Yorker piece called The Really Big One by Catherine Schultz. An earthquake will destroy a sizable portion of the coastal Northwest. The question is when. This got shared so much on social media, and I know all three of you have read this article. Jack, what were your overall thoughts on this piece?
Well, it actually, it sounds a lot like what Anna Marie is arguing against, which is sort of the fear-based element. They have the same problem, although it's a different type of earthquake up there as we have. And the concern in the Pacific Northwest is a recurrence of this earthquake that is graded as a magnitude 9 earthquake that occurred in 1700. Similarly, we're concerned in the Bay Area, everybody's concerned when they say the big one, what they're talking about is a recurrence of the 1906 earthquake. Well, in the Bay Area, or for the 1906 earthquake, we think that the recurrence interval is 200 years, and we've gone 100 years after that earthquake. So the probability of that earthquake actually recurring in the next 30 years is only like 10 or 12%. And I think it's similar for a recurrence of the magnitude 9 1700 earthquake in there. But there will be smaller damaging earthquakes. And when I say smaller, there's still very large earthquakes, damaging earthquakes in the Bay Area and in the Pacific Northwest.
And this piece specifically focused on the Cascadia subduction zone, which runs for 700 miles off the coast of the Pacific Northwest, continuing along Oregon and Washington. And Catherine Schultz wrote that when the rupture happens, there will be an unprecedented amount of destruction. The piece scared a lot of people, but a lot of people were also talking about complacency around this issue. Danielle, what were your thoughts about just the attention that this piece got?
I think you're right. The article scared a lot of people. It certainly scared me, but it didn't give us a lot to work with in terms of what, if I lived in the Pacific Northwest, what should I do about that? It didn't answer those questions for me.
Anna Marie?
This is the type of article that I have a great deal of upset around because it is intentionally hyperbolic in its language, and it's meant to do that, get people to take action. We have done that for more than 100 years. And the public has a very specific way they start relating to all people in emergency management. And I learned this because my best friend came to a party where I had my non-emergency management friends and my emergency management friends. And she said after the party, it was lovely to meet your emergency management friends, even though they're a bit, how should I say it, creepy. And I said, what do you mean? And then it dawned on me. She was right. She said, you know, you say things to each other like, oh, my goodness, I haven't seen you since Loma Prieta, or, oh, my God, do you remember Oakland Hills firestorm? And, you know, we have that remembrance of the great times we had and how hard we worked. And then some of the creepier ones say things like, oh, what we really need is an earthquake to shake things up. And, you know, it's the public hates that. The average person does not want that type of conversation. They look to avoid that. So when we have that sort of hyperbolic language in the articles, it winds up spurring the doomsday preppers. I mean, the doomsday preppers had a field day off of that article. And doomsday preppers, I'm telling you, if you ever want to have an interesting experience, get deep with the people who are survivalists and doomsday preppers, and all of their conversations ultimately go to, well, we've got to have guns and ammo to protect ourselves against the marauding neighbors. We don't need that kind of language. I mean, honestly, I want people to go fear-free and join the Go Fear-Free movement and really be the ones to step up and say, you know what? My company is not going to invest in this fear-based language, because really, that's what it does.
Anna Marie Jones is Executive Director of Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. Danielle Mueller is the Resilience Program Coordinator at the Association of Bay Area Governments. And Dr. Jack Boatwright is Senior Seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. On today's Your Call, we are talking about earthquakes and preparedness. You will most likely experience the next big one in California in your lifetime. So what questions do you have about it? How are you preparing? What are your thoughts about messaging? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hello. Yes, I have a idea that if it was a tax write-off for people to spend up to $1,000 on emergency preparedness of water, canned goods, you know, and make it a good list, you know, like I live in San Francisco, so if I as a renter did that, and if my landlord got a tax write-off for the same amount, you know, it would, and if you could do it every 4 years, you know, to keep everything up to date, then it would be a no-brainer. Everybody could take that tax write-off every 4 years and buy $1,000 worth of emergency preparedness. That'd be enough for several people. Water, you know, if you're going to buy enough water for 2 weeks, you know, a big earthquake in San Francisco, okay, there's no bridges, no cell phones. What are we going to do, you know? And it's, I volunteered for the Red Cross DAT team, and, you know, you realize that, sure, you can open up a school gym for people to get into, but if there's a Hayward Fault earthquake, you know, 100,000 people could be displaced. There's not enough hospital beds, radios, you know, volunteer coordinators. It's quite I think the city and the state has to take responsibility for establishing it. Anyway, so that's my defense.
Well, thank you for the idea. So there's an idea of tax write-offs. Mimi writes in, instead of spending billions of dollars on messaging, why not distribute earthquake preparedness kits to everyone for free? It wouldn't cost billions and would be in the step in the right direction. What are your thoughts on that, Anne-Marie?
as a veteran of 25 years of watching programs like that, it just doesn't play out the way it seems like it would on the surface. People who have a lot of money who wouldn't, one, need that. For that, it's, you know, kind of a no gain. Most people aren't that willing to do that to begin with. And the poorest people, what are they going to do with that? They're going to sell stuff. We've seen this in all of the giveaway programs. If you're poor, you will field strip that kit really quickly. You keep the stuff that is keepable, usable, eatable, and then you see blankets on the street with, you know, all the little transistor radios and all the little food packs. It's a great thing in theory, but it rarely plays out the way we'd like it to. But I would say, if there are people who wish to incentivize preparedness, there are many ways to do it. I mean, there must be someone listening who really is tired of all this fear and threat and wants to do the, you know, go fear-free. There are lots of ways to incentivize preparedness, particularly for marginalized communities.
Hmm. And what about this? Because we have a couple callers who couldn't stand in line who want to know more about how to prepare. So what is at the top of your list, Anna Marie?
I would go first and foremost for changing their relationship to the conversation. Remember, they're not preparing for the earthquake, flood, and the horrible. They're preparing to be great in the face of crisis. They're preparing to love and protect their families. So once you get your innards right about this, all of the externals start to fall in place. Training your brain, programming your phone, and doing things like controlling your ambient environment. The things you can control in your ambient environment, control it. Every business in this state could do some of the tactics that we have devised at CARD. Like, we call it disaster wayfinding. When you give directions inside your company, instead of saying, oh, the ladies' room is down the hall, turn left after, you know, say, oh, the ladies' room is down the hall. If you reach the emergency exit, then you've gone too far. Or turn left when you see the fire extinguisher. Because that way, every person in the building would know where all of the safety indicators are. But every guest would also be given directions, and they would know where it is. There are hundreds of things like that that would make all the difference.
Danielle, what would you add?
I have nothing to add. I mean, I think Anna-Marie covers it so well.
How do you prepare personally?
Personally, I try to keep my pantry stocked, keep the canned goods in my pantry, and I go through them regularly, but I restock them. I've got some buckets of water under my porch, and I've got my camping gear in the garage.
What about you, Jack?
Well, I'm concerned with the question that a caller touched on, which was the shelter population. I mean, one of the big emphasis that we've had, and I say we because the survey has funded some of this work, and Danielle's doing a lot of this work, is the question of resilience. We really want, when a disaster happens, for people not to be evacuated, for people to be able to shelter in their houses, and or shelter in their residences. And to accomplish that, we have to make certain that that they're using not a collapse hazard building code, but a habitability building code. And that's a really critical development that's happened over the last 10 or 7 years, and I'd like to see that implemented far more strongly. And part of the utility of the software story ordinance is it's really a habitability issue.
And also, what would you add for preparedness, just for the basics?
Well, the concern that I have in San Francisco is fire following earthquake. Because there's so many wooden structures. You know, every house is built next to, is right on the next house. So it's a really simple thing of making sure your water heater is strapped. I mean, that's what the fire in the marina in 1989 was caused by. It was a soft first-story building with an unstrapped water heater. These are straightforward things. I'm totally behind Anna Marie's idea of empowering people or empowering people, businesses, communities by doing the small things. Mm. And, you know, it is useless running around saying, oh, the big earthquake is coming. You have to. but you can take more control of the elements of your life right. by doing these
and
things.
And when you say make sure the water heater is strapped, what do you mean by that?
Well, water heaters, most water heaters are these vertical
right.
pieces so that with connecting gas to it, what you're strapping to keep it from toppling over. So
okay.
when it topples over, it tears the, or it breaks the gas main, so you have a gas leak with a fire. And that's what happened.
Okay, I haven't heard that one before. So make sure the water heater is strapped. And if you rent, you might want to ask your landlord, because sometimes you have these storage rooms and the water heaters and maybe your neighbor's storage room. Maybe you've never even seen your water mm-hmm. heater. So you might want to ask your landlord to make sure the water heater is strapped. Thank you for that. Anything else, like just very, you know, good tips that don't get as much attention as water and food and tent supplies and a transistor radio also is important. Anything else?
Go for highly portable, those rollable suitcases and things, so that in a moment's notice, you are literally able to just, bam, just stand up and leave. If you have to get out of Dodge, do it quickly. So do not have things stored on a fancy pantry shelf. That's great for everyday life. But if you're talking your go kit, if you're talking that thing that's going to help you, make sure it's incredibly portable. Think like a backpacking camper and be able to just stand up and just
and
walk
go.
Out.
Okay, that's a good one. Danielle?
I think along the lines of the water heater, you can bolt your bookshelves to the wall. There's lots of straps you can buy. You can tie down your TV and computer monitors to keep those from falling over. It's particularly good in kind of small, moderate-sized earthquakes where you're not going to have a lot of damage, but it'll keep your computer from shattering, your TV from shattering and falling on people and can hurt people.
And it also provides some protection from theft. We remember years ago when, I think it was Berkeley High, did a non-structural hazard program. When thieves broke in, they weren't able to just easily just grab stuff and go because everything was all strapped down.
Yeah. And it's great if you have small kids, too, to keep them from falling. Pulling shelves down or not.
Right.
Exactly.
I've also been thinking about phones because so many of us no longer have landlines.
Yes.
And the battery dies pretty quickly in the cell phone. So you might want to buy an additional battery and make sure that's always charged.
Make sure you have many, many people have cars.
Mm-hmm.
Just make sure you have the little battery charger that fits into the cigarette lighter
right.
in your car.
I have my phone in a Mophie charger case, so when my phone is near dead, I just click a button and boom, the entire thing recharges. And doing exactly what Jack said, have it in your car, have it at your desk, always be ready to charge up. It's one of the best things you can do because I promise you, the level of stress you will have from suddenly not having your phone is emotionally devastating to you.
Right. We just got an email from Barb about phone companies going to fiber optics, mm-hmm. which are no longer landlines, and then the backup battery only lasts for about a day or 2 days. So thanks for bringing that one up. Jane writes, I live in Santa Cruz and recall the Loma Prieta quake very well. At the time, I grabbed my child, crouched in a doorway of my home, and waited for the house to fall on us. The only thing I'd ever heard was that doorways were the safest, strongest point in any edifice. Later, I saw online a lot of talk about the importance of avoiding hiding underneath a desk or a bed because it could crush you, and to find a triangular space to stay in would be best. What's true and what isn't? Just quickly.
Say no to anything that says triangle of life. That was done for very political and money-baiting reasons. And the truth is, triangles do form under certain circumstances, but knowing where they would form, that is really quite the extreme experience. Doorways, no, they used to be the strongest place when we lived in softer buildings. But now with current codes, absolutely not. And a good, strong desk is still an excellent bet. And, of course, move away from glass and windows and things that can smash and break.
Any other tips about what you should do if you're in an office building or in your home when this happens? Danielle?
Anna Marie's absolutely right. Get under a desk or a sturdy object. Make sure you hold on to it so that it doesn't kind of walk away from you. One of the reasons that the doorways are not as safe is because you are exposed to things that can fly around and hit you. So under the desk, cover up your head, hold on to the legs, and you're pretty safe.
And if you live on, say, the bottom floor of a building, should you try to get out of it or
no?
No.
It's very unlikely that buildings built to current codes are going to collapse the way we see them happening in Nepal and in more developing countries. Most of our buildings do not collapse, but you can be very badly damaged going out of a building if brick facades fall, roof tiles fall, glass windows fall. Those can be very damaging to people who are trying to exit the building during shaking.
Yeah, there were two women killed in Paso Robles. Exiting a building when the tenement fell.
Yep.
Okay, well, so do not exit the building.
Don't.
Until the shaking stops.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And Jack, 30 seconds. And final thoughts on preparedness?
Well, I think this conversation has been really a good conversation. I would love to see more empowerment along the lines of what Anna Marie's been saying, of various organizations. You could consider an organization in the same way as you consider an individual, which is if they can do a small thing, that will make them more likely to do another small thing towards it. And I think that's important. I think on the other side that the we really have to look to the municipalities to be concerned about things.
Dr. Jack Boatwright is senior seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Anna Marie Jones is with Collaborating Agencies Responding to Disasters. And Danielle Mueller is Resilience Program Coordinator at the Association of Bay Area Governments. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And go fear free.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. A year after Ferguson, how have your views on race and police changed? On the next Your Call, we'll look back at how the death of unarmed teenager Michael Brown ignited the Black Lives Matter movement. Since protests erupted a year ago, 24 states have adopted measures to reform police practices. Racial justice and police brutality issues are now making it into the platforms of presidential hopefuls. So what substantial changes have been made? What else is needed? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.